So.
Well, thank you, Judge Williams, and I did see 2 minutes, so I'm going to try and come in at six or under. The topic here is Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, and in particular, the portion that deals with unfair methods of competition. The first question, as I understand it, is this statute meant to go beyond what I will call the antitrust laws, the Sherman, the Clayton Acts? And I think that's an easy question. There's little doubt, if you look at the legislative history, that Congress intended that the statute would be broader. The harder question is exactly how, and whether or not that is a good idea, and whether or not the courts will let the agencies enforce it in a way that goes beyond the antitrust laws. And I think it's become an increasingly difficult topic to the extent that the agency is interested in doing so, because over time we've come to, if you will, refine the scope of the antitrust laws, the Sherman Act, the Clayton Act. And so at this point in time, I would suggest that if Section 5 is going to apply to a, I will say, competition-related issue that is not already covered by the Sherman and Clayton Acts, that means there is either some jurisdictional gap in the antitrust laws that you're trying to cover, and there is an example of that. People talk about invitations to collude. But the other is that you have trouble defining whether there's actually harm to competition. Because if you lack a if you don't have a jurisdictional gap and you can show harm to competition, then the odds are you probably have recourse under the current antitrust laws. So we're by definition in an area where you're seeking to enforce the law where there's not clear harm to competition. That's a hard challenge. And I say this with great respect to the individuals who have been trying in good faith to address this in recent years, but I am going to suggest that the FTC has put us in basically the worst of all possible worlds in this regard. And that is because they have tried to expand the application of Section 5, but have done so in a way that has been ineffective, that has created uncertainty and confusion, and that has actually undermined the legitimacy of what I will call standalone Section 5 claims. You can go back a couple of decades ago when the FTC tried to suggest that interdependent behavior, if you know what I mean by that, can violate Section 5. And the courts looked at this and said, well, if I'm a business trying to operate in the economy, how am I supposed to, one, know where the line is, and two, comply with the law once I know where the line is? And if you are particularly in a market with relatively few players, it's very hard to tell you you're supposed to compete while ignoring what your competitors are doing. And that impossibility caused the courts to step back and say, no, we're not going to let you do that. More recently, there was a renewed round of rhetoric suggesting that the FTC was going to expand enforcement in Section 5, and some folks will talk about that. And with respect, there was, I will point as an example to the Ovation decision, where two commissioners suggested that they would have challenged an acquisition in the pharmaceutical industry where there was no horizontal overlap and there was no vertical foreclosure issue. And these are my words, not their words. Basically, you had a change in ownership where the new owner had a different way of going to market and raised the price, exercised market power that may have already been there. If that becomes a violation of Section 5, then virtually any acquisition of any asset by any company in the economy theoretically could violate Section 5. Statements like that created a fair amount of anxiety within the business community and created confusion about what is the line, when am I going to cross it, and how can I comply? The same issues that the courts had raised before. Now, to their credit, a number of these same folks stood up and said, we understand we need to give guiding principles. We need to give people some understanding of where the lines are. But with respect, the guidance that they provided didn't provide a lot of guidance. If I can draw upon a metaphor, it was telling all of the captains sailing ocean-going vessels, we're going to create a lot of waves. We're not going to tell you how big they are or where they're coming from. Just be ready for them. That's not the most productive exercise. And further, by attempting to articulate a set of principles that really didn't seem to have a limit to them, you create the impression that it may be difficult to do. And if the agency is going to enforce in this area, it undermines the credibility. The courts and others who are viewing it are going to have a degree of skepticism that this is, we are embarking on a journey where the rules are unclear. And there have even been statements suggesting that, you know, don't worry if we can't articulate principles. Look at our enforcement actions and you can infer them. I would suggest that that's not a good way to run an economy. I will conclude by saying that there have been recent efforts by current commissioners, and you'll hear from one of them, to try to step up and address this area. And I also want to be very clear, and I will stipulate on the record, it's very easy for me to say people have not achieved the goal they're trying to achieve. In other words, it's easy to criticize. I acknowledge I don't have the answer. I can't tell you what the guiding principles are. And I will conclude by saying, in light of that, I would be very careful about suggesting expanded enforcement unless and until I could develop such principles.
Thank you very much, Judge. Let me start by articulating a couple of propositions. First of all, I'm speaking only for myself, not for anybody on the commission or for the law firm. And second, I do not favor the commission trying to adopt a single unified Section 5 statement. That, in my opinion, would simply try to herd five cats into one bag, which I think is very hard to do. Now, looking back, I first began talking about Section 5 in the competitive impact statement that the commission issued in the NDATA case in 2007. At that time, I said that the Supreme Court in the S&H case had held that Section 5 was broader in reach and deeper in scope than the Sherman Act. I noted that that S&H had been primarily concerned with consumer protection law, not antitrust law. So I tethered Section 5 to consumer protection law in data by relying principally on the 11th Circuit's decision in Orkin Exterminating Company, which was a consumer protection case endorsed by former commissioner and chairman Tim Muras. To be sure, the commission's opinion could be emulated in proceedings brought under the Little FTC Acts, as Commissioner Kovacic pointed out, but private remedies were limited even in that context. So when I first dipped my toe into the Section 5 waters, I considered my views to be pretty non-controversial. Similarly, my welcoming remarks at the 2008 workshop on Section 5 were non-threatening. I said that insofar as Section 5 referred at all to a standalone unfair methods of competition claim, the decision just meant that Section 5 would not apply where conduct had not been held by the appellate courts to be lawful under the Sherman Act or the Clayton Act, and that was all the trilogy of lower appellate court decisions. And I'm referring now to Boise Cascade and Official Airlines Guide and Ethel, properly read, had held that the commission alone was authorized under to invoke Section 5, so there could be no slop over of a commission opinion under Section 5 to a federal antitrust private action under the antitrust laws. Pretty pale pabulum, I thought, at least as compared with colleagues who threw far more bombs than I. The first time I really began to flesh out my views was in some remarks I made at the ABA's antitrust section spring meeting held in March of 2009. There I described four propositions. The first was that Section 5 was intended by Congress, not just the Supreme Court in S&H, to be broader than the Sherman or Clayton Acts. The second was that Section 5 could be displaced by Section 2 appellate court jurisprudence, not by a mere failure of proof of some element of those opinions. The third was that private antitrust actions brought under the little FTC acts were largely a figment of the imagination when no such actions were brought in the wake of NDATA. And fourth and finally, I said that conduct ought to be injurious to consumers in the long run, lest Section 5 be applied to as unfair to competitors, not to competition. That, I thought, was just consistent with the Supreme Court's teachings in cases like Pueblo Bolomat. I made three predictions in those remarks. First, I predicted that Section 5 would not be limited to filling gaps under the Sherman or Clayton Act. I had in mind the American Airlines decision, which was inspired by, and this was a Fifth Circuit decision, by the way, that was inspired by Bill Baxter's attempt to create a private cause of action for an attempt to compete, to conspire to monopolize. I considered that to be completely illegitimate and unfounded. Second, I predicted that Section 5 might be used to challenge actions that occurred in a duopoly or tight oligopoly market. That was a little bolder, but not much, because it meant that the statute would not be applied to most firms engaging in single firm conduct because they would not be doing business in those concentrated markets. And third, with a deep bow to Professor Land, who I've cited on other occasions, I predicted that Section 5 might be used to challenge conduct that might stifle or cripple consumer choice. To me, as well as to Joseph Schumpeter, by the way, describing consumer choice as a dimension of competition just expanded standing to sue to cover non-price as well as price competition, which I thought it ought to be done. In remarks I made to some LECG economists at Newport in October of 2009, I made some new points, which I incorporated in later remarks that I made in Canada and Southern California and Washington and New York. I warned that there was very little unified Section 2 precedent because of the existence of numerous regional appellate courts and because the Supreme Court had either failed or refused to identify clear Section 2 law. Even in Brook Group, I noted, the Supreme Court refused to define below-cost pricing. Finally, I think, however, one has to ask, what makes the FTC unique, so that a warrant, that a special statute like Section 5 for it is warranted. With economists' rates going through the roof, and I should say also lawyers' rates, astronomically, I am tempted to point to the Commission's own Bureau of Economics. But the DOJ also has an in-house economist. Yet it is still bound to adhere to the Sherman and Clayton Acts. The FTC is a bipartisan agency, as is the ITC. But so is the FCC. As Commissioner Olhausen stated earlier this month, the FCC is a lawmaker and the FTC is a law enforcer, and this may make a difference. I would argue, and in fact, in 2010, I did argue that the FTC's Bureau of Consumer Protection makes it unique. As Commissioner Kovacic earlier observed, the FTC is a better antitrust agency for having a consumer protection capability too. And I would argue that that's what sets the FTC apart. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Olhausen, please.
Great. Thank you so much, Judge. I'm delighted to be here today. And first off, I'll just note that my remarks are my own. So talking about Section 5, as Tom Barnett alluded to, earlier this year I gave a speech on what I believe is the appropriate scope of Section 5 called Principles of Navigation. And I wanted to give you all today a little bit of an insight into how I came about to reach that position, and then what my position is. So thinking back, I looked all the way back to what my swearing-in remarks were in April of 2012. And at my swearing-in ceremony, I talked about the importance of the FTC using all of its tools to pursue its mission. And most importantly, when we're reaching a decision, one of the things we need to keep in mind is the FTC may not always be the right actor to address an issue. Sometimes or often it should be the market that can give the solution, or sometimes it's another part of government, another institution that may be better suited to the task, and that's something I always try to keep in mind. Another important issue is the need for transparency and clarity in what we're doing and what we're not doing, and also a very much a focus on improving consumer welfare. So starting out with those premises in mind, as I began my tenure as an FTC commissioner, there were certain matters that came before me that raised concerns for me. So I objected when the commission rescinded its disgorgement policy statement in August of 2012. I thought it was very important that we, if it needed updating, certainly we could consider updating it, but that to withdraw clear guidance and not put anything in its place wasn't really a good way to proceed. Then the commission brought two Section 5 cases later that year. The Bosch, it was a settlement of a merger case, and a settlement with Google having to do with standard essential patents. And in both of those matters, I was concerned that we were proceeding under Section 5 without giving a clear policy statement, clear guidance on what the parameters of Section 5 were. So these three developments really brought home for me the need to develop, if we are going to proceed using Section 5 expansively, the need to have a clear policy statement explaining what we're doing and what we're not doing. And so when I went and sort of delved into this topic, I looked for what would be some good guideposts, what would be some good concepts to draw upon in fashioning what Section 5 expansive Section 5 unfair methods should be. So one of the things that I looked at was there's an executive order called 12866. And some of you may not be familiar with it, but I like to joke that at my home, we speak of little else than this executive order. But it actually, I think, lays out some very good guideposts for if an agency is thinking of taking action in a certain area, what should it think about? What should it should it look at? And so the executive order laid out some core guidance to federal agencies considering regulations, economic regulations. So first is to identify a significant market failure or systemic problem requiring regulation. Second, to evaluate alternative approaches to that regulation. Third, to choose the regulatory action that's most cost-effective and imposes the least burden on society. Next, to avoid regulations that are inconsistent with or duplicative of those that it or other federal agencies already have in place. Next, to base the regulatory proposal on the best available economic and other evidence. And then finally, to understand the expected effects of the regulation on those who bear the costs of the regulation and those who enjoy its benefits. So taking this general framework, and I'm not saying that the FTC needs to undergo formal OMB and OIRA approval for every action that it takes, but more that we should look at this well-developed, well-accepted framework for regulation and say, okay, if we're going to use Section 5 expansively, how does that counsel what that should look like? So here's what I came up with. Here's the core of the principles of navigation that I put forward over the summer. So first, I said we should use unfair methods of competition only in cases of substantial harm to competition. And second, we should use Section 5 only where there is no pro-competitive justification for the challenged conduct or where such conduct results in harm to competition that's disproportionate to its benefits. Third, in using unfair methods, we should avoid or minimize conflict with other institutions, most notably the Department of Justice Antitrust Division, with whom we share competition oversight. Fourth, unfair methods of competition enforcement must be grounded in robust economic evidence regarding the anti-competitive effects of the challenged conduct. Fifth, prior to using unfair methods, the FTC should consider using many of its non-enforcement tools to address the perceived competitive problem. And this one is especially near and dear to my heart because in a previous incarnation of the FTC, I used to head up our Office of Policy Planning and I ran the Competition Advocacy Program and engaged in a lot of research and consideration of where, if we can't bring an enforcement action, what should the FTC be doing to address a perceived competitive problem? So it's something that I think the FTC actually has a lot of experience and expertise in doing that kind of analysis. And then finally, the agency should provide clear guidance and minimize the potential for uncertainty in the unfair methods area. And during the discussion, I'd be happy to go more deeply into these factors. So one of the real points of my speech over the summer was also to ask the question, okay, the courts might say, SNH, the Supreme Court may have given us more leeway, or going back in the legislative history of the FTC almost 100 years ago, some senators may have expressed views that we should use Section 5 more expansively. And all that is interesting and worthy of study, but my question was, should we be doing this? Now, can we do this? Should we be doing this? Is this something that's really going to make consumers better off, going to make us a more effective agency or not? And in asking that question, what I really focused on is the FTC's success in improving the traditional antitrust laws. And I think we have a very good story to tell there about how our investment in policy research and developing cases and developing challenges and case law that have helped clarify the antitrust laws are where we've really made some important strides. So, you know, we all operate in a world of trade-offs and in, every agency has limited resources. So I really urge that that's where we put our energies. Rather than spending a lot of time on Section 5 and saying, can we use it expansively? Can we do this? Can we do that? That we really look at, improving the antitrust laws. Because I think that also, consistent with the principles I laid out, minimizes some of the problems that I see from using Section 5 expansively, particularly the institutional conflicts that it creates with other agencies, other enforcers who are well situated to address some of these problems, such as the ITC, and Scott can address the ITC. But in one other issue is the FTC and the Department of Justice share oversight of competitive matters. If you have a fundamentally different standard of liability for activity or industries that are overseen by the FTC versus the Department of Justice, I think that creates a problem that over the long term is not clear guidance for industry and ultimately could cause some problems for the FTC as saying, well, you know, we want to be in that game too. We're effective. We're a competition regulator. Having a substantially different liability standard may ultimately cause some problems for the FTC. So I think I've used 9 minutes. I see it a minute back. But I'll save it for rebuttal. And anyway, I look forward to the discussion.
Professor Balder.
Thanks so very much. I want to commend for all of you to sit down and read Maureen's wonderful speech. As far as I can tell, it's the most magnificent use of a metaphor ever in an antitrust speech. She constantly navigates, sets sail, and so forth. And it's the only speech, the only antitrust speech in history to actually cite a physical object, a globe, in the New York Public Library, and also quote President Washington. So I don't know what more you could expect.
It was a lot of fun to write.
100 years ago, Congress created the FTC, and the question is why? And I think one of the reasons why was they were dissatisfied with the Sherman Act, and they were dissatisfied with traditional antitrust enforcement. I think one of the great things about the commission, led by people like Tim Uris, Bill Kovacic, is that they are great at self-examination, and I think the examination of using its the proper use of its Section 5 power is appropriate, but I wonder why there's all this tempest about it. I'm somebody who really strongly believes in antitrust enforcement, and the use of Section 5 has been extraordinarily modest. I don't sort of see this as, I mean, the number of cases we're talking about here, by the way, antitrust lawyers like to endlessly debate cases or small matters over and over again, but this isn't a question of agencies setting sea on an agency setting sail on a sea of doubt. This is like a bunch of Talmudic scholars standing on dry land wondering what the sand's going to feel like. I mean, we just don't have those kind of enforcement actions here. And I also don't see much out there that sort of says, from the perspective of businesses, here's this good thing I wanted to do for consumers, but damn it, that Section 5, that kept me from getting it done. So if, at least from a public interest perspective, I have difficulty seeing what the problem is here. I do see reasons why Section 5 needs to be used, and to the extent Maureen and her colleague Josh Wright revitalize a debate about Section 5 and build on the work that Tom does, that's helpful if it leads to enforcement actions. From a public interest perspective, we see oligopolistic markets in which there are significant price increases. We see the law, the traditional Section 2, the Sherman Act tools, being increasingly restricted by Supreme Court decisions, not only in terms of the scope of the substantive law, but also in terms of procedural barriers, courts probably being appropriately skeptical of cases brought by private plaintiffs, which seem to focus on treble damages. That's an important difference, and everybody here, I think, recognizes it. When the FTC brings a case, it's bringing it as a public interest enforcer, not simply as a private litigant, and I think that's why their litigation in this area is so tremendously important. But let me give you some examples. So I figured I had to say I agree with the large part of the principles Maureen attests to, because they're pretty simple and straightforward, and I don't think there's like a lot of difference. But the debate is going to be on what kind of cases should actually be brought. And you know, for those of you who you know don't really like antitrust enforcement, you might want to take a Pepcid or something like that, so you don't get your stomach doesn't get turned. But let me give you an example. There's a lot that gets lost in the antitrust laws. There was a case brought in the Ninth Circuit several years ago involving an insurance company which was regularly paying kickbacks to insurance agents to sort of move, you know, sort of, and to engage in deceptive conduct to, you know, move customers over to them. And an antitrust case was brought by a competitor, and the court said, well, this firm doing this, it has a small market share, we don't see a relevant market, but there is clear evidence of consumer harm. Consumers were being deceived, they were ended up paying more in insurance premiums. Second, you can't walk a street in Washington before you get hit with some advocacy about patent trolls. Patent trolls are the scum of the earth. They are people who just bring cases simply to shake down legitimate companies. Now, I know there are limits to, you know, antitrust cases, you know, and there are appropriate limits to those cases, but damn it, you know, isn't this an area where we'd like to see Section 5 try an attempt to use Section 5 competitively? Is the conduct harmful to consumers? I definitely think so. Is it, you know, something where there's no efficiency justification? Yeah. And would an antitrust case, a traditional antitrust case, get lost on the shoals of relevant market and things like that? Probably yes. But, you know, those are the kinds of areas where I think you could. It would be appropriate. Now, let me say a couple things about the idea of guidelines and marine standards. First of all, I think there's a legitimate point to be made that guidance is best provided through actual cases being brought, and I welcome the Section 5 cases that Maureen's going to bring in administrative litigation and develop, as she, you know, correctly points out, the commission's so good at developing the law at the end of her remarks. So it could be better developed through the litigation. Second, there's this problem with guidelines. You know, Tom Barnett knows it. He wrote this magnificent report about Section 2 standards, and then, whoops, the president changed, and the report got thrown in the wastebasket. So I think we got to be a little cautious about, you know, what happens to guidelines and, you know, just guidelines by an individual agency. Third, the reason for this is to improve the commission's hand in litigation. And I sort of get a feel for judges, and maybe Judge Williams will talk about this, but I don't know if just having some guidelines behind your action is really going to improve your chances of success. Finally, I think it's a really interesting idea to sort of tie these to the executive order, which I've tried to read to my wife, but she falls asleep after the first sentence, unlike in Maureen's house. But look, those guidelines are for when you want to establish regulations to regulate an entire industry. And we all know that it's impossible to get rid of regulations once you impose them, so they appropriately set a very, very high threshold. So I'm not as sure that they really apply to individual enforcement actions, but I think it's great that Maureen's identified that as something that could conceivably be lodestars to future guidelines.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and I really appreciate the remarks by the other panelists. And just at the outset, if I could reiterate that I too am not speaking on behalf of my employer or colleagues, present or former. Our panel asks us to think about penumbras. Penumbras are fun to think about. What's a penumbra? It's of course an area of the shadow. When you look at an object and you see the shadow, the penumbra is the thing, the part of the shadow, that makes it look like the object has fuzzy borders. So if you're looking down at two distinct objects, they might have shadows, they might have umbras and penumbras. The penumbra is what makes it look like you can't tell where one of those objects ends, where the other one begins. If you're thinking about a Venn diagram, it's like you can't tell whether there's overlap or not. So Maureen and her colleague Josh Wright, who is here today for another panel, may or may not be in the room, but Josh and Maureen have both proposed guidelines that are designed to help decision makers in the market and in government figure out whether Section 5 has been violated or not. So they're trying to make it easy for people to figure that out. They're trying to make it easy to figure out what's in the zone of illegality and what's in the zone of legality. And their approach looks at several things. What are particularized harms to competition? And what are particular countervailing benefits to the targeted conduct? There's a lot of common sense in these approaches and in similar approaches. And of course, approaches that tack or sail in a different direction, some of which we've also heard about today, are also well motivated and well conceived. So I just want to offer an additional feature to the approaches that we first talked about, the ones that Maureen and Josh and others have explored. And I want to just give some signposting here and tell you right up front where I'm going. A convenient label for what I hope we can think about is something that we might call the basics matter. By that I mean a mindfulness that takes seriously the important goals and concerns of diverse perspectives that informed our development of areas of law about which we basically all agree. The idea here is to start with areas where we have a lot of consensus. I think this would be a feature. Of course, this feature would have to be balanced by policymakers against inevitable flaws. Even if in net the features outweigh the flaws, I recognize that one size may not fit all, and the second set of approaches may very well be well-suited for certain areas. But let's talk about this added feature of those first set of approaches. So back in ancient times, and by that I mean 2004, this is before the financial system crashed and before a lot of legal innovation in response to the financial system crash. It was also before the roughly decade of IP antitrust activity at various agencies and various committees on the Hill and various courts. And it was at a time when I and a co-author were academics. Troy Paredes and I had written an article in the GW Law Review back then about We didn't call it penumbras, we called it periphery, but at least we kept the alliteration and the P. And we were trying to wrestle with the interactions among various doctrines in IP law, contract law, the law of federal preemption, and it built on other work we had done in corporate securities and bankruptcy. So our hope and our thought was that this basics matter approach would be simple and attractive. So think about this. Think about a setting in which one or more relatively sophisticated business parties are in an ongoing voluntary relationship, something that a first-year law student would call contract. Whether it's actually written down or not, they're choosing, those parties are choosing to continue to interact together. So the basic matter approach would say, look, let's pay very careful attention to what a law student would call the outline of the black letter law of contract, property, fraud, intellectual property, or an economist might call hold up. You could pick the topic, but you would then get into the topic. And you would then think, for example, in the context of property law or contract law, about the consensus positive law rules about what makes the contract or the property enforceable, what remedies would be available, and on what terms. And you would also think about, for example, the aspects of the black letter law of antitrust that, for example, pay attention to market power or its threat. And you would engage, you would be mindful to engage in those thoughts before moving on to an open textured doctrine like patent misuse or Section 5 of the FTC Act or other broad similar public policy or public interest legal tests that other agencies and other parts of the government apply in various settings. And you would then take, as you enter these broader, the analysis for these broader open textured areas, you take with you the learning you had done about those other more basic doctrines. So, for example, you'd think seriously about the normative debates, the policy debates, that required in contract law offer acceptance and consideration. You'd think about, gosh, why did people care about that? You'd think your example of the insurance agent, that sounds like fraud. But then you'd ask yourself, why did we make fraud have, to use law school parlance, several elements? Was that to trick up law students? No, it's because we thought it was important to signal to actors what counted as fraud and what didn't, and because we thought there were good reasons to be concerned about those four factors. Maybe we should add or subtract one, but we would then go back to the debates about why that factor came into existence in the first place. So this approach to entering these more open textured areas, like Section 5, is an approach that cabins decision makers, because they then have to go back to those prior debates and find specific holes they're trying to fill or specific clashes they're trying to resolve. And the mere formality of identifying and rigorously considering those different factors and those different bodies of law will give a lot of respect and dignity to those different perspectives. And why is that such a bad thing? So maybe I'm just too mired in my prior work as a mediator to think that encouraging respect and dignity for diverse perspectives is a good thing, but I'm pretty sure it can help us, and I think it's an added feature of these perspectives. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I'll...
I'm going to exercise the privilege of the chair to ask one question, which might introduce a set of statements, and that is, it struck me that if there were ever to be a poster child for expansion of Section 5 or broad interpretation of Section 5, it would be patent trolls. So I was wondering if David could take a minute or two to explain how the war on patent trolls would fit within Section 5, and then other panelists might respond to that.
Sure. Following Maureen's analysis, even under Maureen's model, litigation by patent trolls, cases which may not be valid or could be, efforts to engage in deceptive practices through litigation, deceptive or inadequate, demand letters, it seems to me fairly straightforward harm to consumers, which is the ultimate lodestar, and I don't think there's some kind of efficiency rationale behind it. That you can get into these giant big picture debates about, whether or not, certain patent assertion entities are engaging in, meritorious conduct because they're improving the financing of patent markets. But, there's this epidemic. I mean, it's a massive typhoon of litigation that's being filed, and there's a great deal of this that's clearly just just tremendously egregious. And the problems with the problem is that self-help is extraordinarily difficult. I mean, by the time you'd actually succeed in a case, you know, as a defendant, it would cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars, even to even to go and assess your potential liability is extraordinarily expensive.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. Go ahead.
So the FTC actually has a study underway right now. We put out the parameters for public comment on what we would call patent assertion entities. And so David raises several points that I sort of wanted to unpack. First, if there is a deceptive demand letter that's going out, that is something that maybe we would look at under our deception authority, which is subject to a deception policy statement that the commission agreed upon a number of years ago when the use of our unfairness authority in the consumer protection area and our deception authority were controversial. So we created policy statements there that the commission agreed to. Maybe we didn't get all five cats in the bag at the same time, but we got five on the unfairness and I think maybe four on deception. But one of the things that I think is very important is, I have mentioned the FTC using all of its tools. And so using our 6B powers to study, because you say there's no efficiencies. How do you know there are no efficiencies if you really haven't done an in-depth study of what is really happening with patent assertion entities? And then one of the other questions is, once we look at this, where is the problem? If there is a problem, what is causing that? Is it a problem in the patent law? Is that something that we should consider whether improvements to the patent law are appropriate or some other approach rather than jumping right to there's a problem, we have a hammer called Section 5 on for methods, let's put those two things together. So I think it kind of calls for the FTC using more of its array of tools to make sure there's a problem and then really understand what that problem is.
In my point is, I think you can use some of those tools, like the deception tool, to bring individual enforcement actions, and maybe more broadly, the unfairness tool.
So just to build on this and to further the mediation goal, and to recognize that a story is a datum, and that never means data of the type Maureen was just describing are so important to marshal before thinking. But because this is an antitrust panel, let's start with a datum. Let's start with a story. A story that we all knew was true. We all knew was true in the economics literature of antitrust for a very, very long time. Just like we knew the earth was flat for a very, very long time. General Motors and Fisher Body engaged in mutual holdup. It was a problem they could not solve but for antitrust regulation, and there was no way a contract could be written to solve that problem. And that was true with a capital T, like the world was flat, until after a lot of effort, I think about 30 years, Ronald Coase and Dan Spolber and a few others, I think Rick Brooks, managed to get a copy of the contract. And lo and behold, right there in that sucker was, by the way, I won't hold you up, you won't hold me up. They had specifically negotiated the solution to hold up themselves. So the story, the ghost story that we had told our antitrust children to frighten them for years, on Halloween and off Halloween, that holdup would ensue in the General Motors Fisher Body setting turned out to be a story. The troll story could be true and it could not be true, but the most famous example is Research in Motion. Everybody see, it's one of the most famous examples. And it may very well be a troll case, it may very well be an inefficiency case, it may very well be an antitrust case, it may very well be an example of failure of some type. But here are some things we know about it that suggest a lot of those things are not true. So the case settled for $600 million. And before I went into the government and I worked in academia, That was a lot of money. It took me like three semesters to make that kind of money. That I get it, okay? $600 million's a lot. It looks like shakedown and it looks like holdup. But we know that the market thought that case was worth $1 billion, twice that. And we know what Research in Motion, the patent infringer, thought it was worth because they were a publicly traded company in Canada. They were telling their shareholders, please keep investing in us. We'll still be profitable if we lose this lawsuit. We've set aside a little treasure trove of cash to pay, and we'll be profitable if we have to pay this little treasure trove of cash. This little treasure trove of cash they set aside, $1.8 billion, 3x. So whatever too much means, it's just worth noticing the too much in this case was half of what the market thought and half of what the user, a third of what the user thought. Now, there's a lot of endogeneity to those things. We might ask ourselves, by the way, what did the patentee ask for, that troll? What did the troll ask for early on in the case? What was the shakedown? And from public sources, the understanding is it was somewhere around 6 million. 1/100th of 600 million. So I don't know what shakedown means, but I think it doesn't mean asking for 1/100th of half of what the market thought and a third of what the infringer thought the value was. Now, maybe there's other endogeneity in the case. Maybe the problem is 600 million and a billion and 1.8 billion each reflected some irrational exuberance about an obviously invalid patent. But then the question is, was 6 million an irrationally exuberant shakedown for an obviously invalid patent? Because 6 million is much smaller than 600 million. And if it was, let's notice that the only reason the case settled for 600 million several years after 6 million was declined is because really good lawyers had spent several years and far more than $6 million litigating around every substantive law patent question on the question relating to validity, which is to say no one managed to find killer prior art, no one managed to show that the patent was not definite or was not enabled or et cetera. So however confident we are that these patents are really bad, we must be least confident of that on the south end, on the far end of a multi-year, multi-million dollar litigation in which we've tested validity and infringement. So I don't know what makes these cases so bad. I look forward to learning that. But at least that case, like General Motors Fisher Body, is a case that often gets discussed, but it seems to be an example of the opposite.
We have someone on the right here.
Yeah, I think Scott has done an excellent job of illustrating, you know, what I think is going on here. And he talked about, and I think it's absolutely right, if you try to put this into an analytically coherent framework, set forth principles that put forth an ability to predict where the law is and where the lines are, that is very constraining upon the agency. And what I hear, and I hear Maureen trying to do just that, and David, I completely agree and endorse your admonition or recommendation of Maureen's writings on this subject. I pretty much disagree with everything else that you said. And it's because, and I'm gonna be a little bit provocative here because I know David's got a thick skin. What he says is, I want to be able to go after because I decide I don't like it. And that's a problem. And listen to what he says. We don't want to use Section 2 because the courts have constrained it. They've reined it in. Well, why did they rein it in? There's a reason they've reined it in. That if you make it a violation to compete aggressively and hurt a competitor without entering the competitive process, that's a good thing. We want to encourage that. So what I hear David saying is, well, because the courts won't let us go after somebody for doing something I don't like because it's part of the competitive process, I want to use Section 5 as a backdoor to get at something. That's not necessarily a good thing. I would argue it's a bad thing. He says, well, there have been no real extreme cases brought, so why are we worried? And I haven't had somebody come out and say, this is something I would like to do. I can tell you from personal experience, he's ignoring the fact that businesses listen to the rhetoric. They listen to the language from these government officials. And there was a period of time where I would have clients come to me the last several years, and they'd say, you know, they actually usually want to comply with the law. That may come as a shock to some people, but they do. And they would say, I want to do X. Can I do that? And we'd say, well, I don't think it violates Sherman Act. I don't think it violates Clayton Act. I don't think it violates the FTC Act as generally enforced. But of course, under this speech given by these two commissioners, it could violate that. And I don't know really what to tell you to do about that. And I agree that over a period of time when there were not extreme cases actually brought, the business community gets a little bit more comfortable with that. But that doesn't mean that there's not a real effect. And by the way, it's frustrating to hear this, well, where's the example? Which business wants to go to the FTC and says, by the way, I would like to do this thing that I think you, this agency, may not like if I do it, and I just want you to know that I'm not doing it because of what you said? I mean, they don't do that. And I'm not saying that there isn't ways to sometimes find out, but the fact that a dog is not barking is sometimes not harmful. So what I will leave you with David's last statement is, you know, guidelines aren't important. They're not good. Well, they are important because they impose a discipline on the process. And the example that was given was, in Washington, whenever you hear somebody use a label instead of explaining the substance, your antennas should go up and say there's something going on here. The, quote, patent troll issue is a very complex issue with legitimate arguments on all sides of it. To just say patent trolls are the scum of the earth and they're a terrible thing with no efficiencies says to me somebody who's not stepping back and thinking through something carefully and rigorously, they're advocating for a particular result.
Let me react a little bit to this. Frankly, I'm not sure where we are. On the one hand, I hear Tom Barnett arguing that there are parameters. They are fixed by by what the Congress intended when it enacted Section 5 of the FTC Act, and they're also fixed to some extent by S&H with respect to the Sherman and Clayton Acts. On the other hand, Marine does not recognize these boundaries at all, as I understand her. So I'm not sure where we end up. My own sense is that we don't end up with respect to Maureen or Tom in terms of letting them make the decisions as to where the boundaries ought to be, because I don't think that matters. At the end of the day, I think what the Congress intended and what the Supreme Court intended in S&H fixes the boundaries of these statutes. Now, I asked the question at the end, what makes the commission unique in this respect, that it needs a special statute? I don't know that there's an answer to that. I'm not sure I have it, and I'm not sure that Tom has it or Maureen has it. But that said, I agree that we should not go after trolls in an instant. I have grave doubts about trying to rein in Section 5, however, based on 6B questionnaires. To my way, it takes time, it's not time well spent. And specifically, I think that it's apparent there have been no cases brought and that have been successfully litigated since Rank Xerox about when Section 7 or Section 2 or Section 1 ought to be applied in these contexts. And one has to ask themselves, why? Why is that? I think that that's indicative of the fact that we have a gut feeling. And I'm sorry to say this, Tom, but Professor Kiefer, but Keefe, but I think that we have a gut feeling that we know the answer to that without 6B questionnaires, without wasting the time of 6B questionnaires. And the answer to that is that the firm with a product in the market is more likely to engage in true innovation than is a troll. That's just the way that I feel about the situation, and I can't be talked out of that with respect to 6B questionnaires.
Okay, Maureen and David have been the targets of some criticism, so I thought I'd give each of them a moment or two to respond and then invite questions.
I'll go first.
Yeah, sure.
David.
So, you know, I definitely appreciate what Commissioner Rush had said about, you know, some of the statements that the Supreme Court has made in the SNH case. They did say that Section 5, you know, can be used broadly and go beyond the letter and spirit of the antitrust laws. My view isn't that I have the answers. Far from it. My view is I really want to make sure we're asking all the questions, because I worry about having confidence in the decisions that we come to if we haven't come to an understanding among ourselves as commissioners about what is the parameters of the statute that we're trying to enforce. And as for looking back at what Congress talked about, one of the things that I, regulatory design has been an interest of mine for quite a while. It was when I mentioned what I used to do in competition advocacy, that was something I paid close attention to. And I read Stephen Breyer's book, Regulation and Its Reform, in preparation of this speech. And one of the things that really struck me, and it's cited in a footnote to my speech on principles of navigation, is I'm saying, if looking 100 years back to say where we should be going in the future, I'm not sure that that's really going to give us the best guidance. And he described it as the stalemate often produced by looking for the justifications of a regulatory program in its authorizing statute, in the arguments of its supporters, or in the underlying motives of those who fought for enactment of the program. Statutes are typically vague, open-ended, or conflicting in their statement of purpose. The arguments of supporters may or may not reflect their underlying objectives, and their true motives are difficult to fathom. So this isn't just in the Section 5 case.
Breyer channeling Justice Scalia.
Yes, perhaps. Yes. So anyway, I think this is a debate, a broader debate about how do we make good policy, good regulations in the economic area in particular. So that's why I thought it was important to draw on these kind of principles to kind of chart our forward course.
Just three quick points. First, on Maureen's point Maureen makes a point in some of her statements about regulatory humility. I'm really queasy about our nation's consumer protection, competition law enforcer paying deference to regulators who may be captured by the industries that may regulate them. I mean, that's well known. In response to two of the points that that Tom made on patent trolls, he's right. It's not. It's cute for me to go and say how they suck, but you know it's not good to use labels. And what we, you know, I think if you get into the individual conduct, I think it's the kind of conduct that, as Maureen's pointed out, you can use the deception standard, and I think you could also use the unfairness standard to go after. Tom raises a really good point about whether or not the law or the interpretation of the law prevents pro-competitive actions. And I think if you look at each of the actions the commission has taken over the last year, there's no story to be told there. If you look at Bosley, which is a case Maureen signed on to, where there was improper information sharing, basically trying to get people to collude, there's not something pro-competitive that was lost there. You know, in data where there was a firm that failed to keep up with a commitment to license its patents, imposing that obligation, I don't think we lost anything pro-competitive on the from the market by using Section 5 there.
Okay, bear in mind that it's very hard for me to see you because the lights are pouring in on me. Do we have a microphone going around? No, so.
There's one in the middle of the room.
Okay, so
standing
I guess that would make it easy. I can't even see, I do see it now. Okay, so if you go to the microphone,
hi, this would go to Commissioner Olhausen, but anyone else could give their comments. I noticed that both you and Commissioner Wright have both called for increased enforcement against invitations to collude and collusion. And I was wondering, it seems that a lot of times when there's controversy over how much to enforce in an issue, such as, for example, with gun control opponents would often say, well, we'll agree to increase the penalties for felons in possession of a handgun or increase the penalties for using a weapon in a crime. And some people think that that leads to over-enforcement in those types of issues. So I'm wondering, because collusion seems to be the one area where most people agree is very bad, if that could possibly lead, because of this disagreement, to over-enforcement of collusion.
So, just to be clear about what my position is I'm not calling for increased enforcement against collusion. I think that the antitrust laws are very much focused on challenging collusion. That it's pretty well accepted that that's where there are problems. I've agreed that I think that using Section 5 as a tool to address invitations to collude, so you don't have an agreement, so it doesn't fall under the Sherman Act, but I think there's pretty clear understanding of the likely harm that could result in that. So now, as for whether there's over focus on that, are we focusing too much on collusion and not focusing our efforts on some other area? I think that could be interesting. It's but since collusion is sort of the core harm that competition laws are, aimed at, I'm not sure that I feel that we've struck the balance in the wrong place.
Thank you. In the wake of the increase in patent litigation that we've seen in the last couple of years, there has been substantial interest in Congress on looking at the problem, hearings, proposed legislative fixes, alterations to the patent law, et cetera. And I would just like to ask the panel their views of whether, in a situation like this, federal agencies should step back and allow leeway for Congress to act, either to encourage them to take action or just to give them space to do so, since legislative changes are usually a time-consuming process. Thank you.
Well, I guess I'm not quite sure I follow this when you say step back, as in decline to pursue an enforcement action that you think you might validly have, so that maybe this is unfair, but so that pressure builds up on Congress to do something. I'm not quite sure if that's what you're getting at. I don't view things, The agencies in Congress I don't view as sort of mutually exclusive. I think that the agencies, to the extent that they have legitimate areas that they should be investigating, and if they have enforcement actions, they should be pursuing those. I think there should be a dialogue with Congress, and I think that they should try and to be, you know, help each other, the, you know, competition advocacy function that I know that Tom and Maureen and others generally espouse is a good thing. And, you know, look, on the patent issue, it is, in my view, for what it's worth, it is a very hard issue. I have my own thoughts about what you might do, and probably Congress will be involved in that. But I guess I don't see quite the same sort of choice between the two.
Any other panelists like to?
Wait, just a second, if I could, Judge. The first point I would make is that I think the principles that govern standard essential patents are completely different from those which ought to govern trolls. Standard essential patents are what the name implies, which is that a patent has been obtained under a standard, and so it locks in everybody who practices the standard. Now, that, to my way of thinking, is governed by contract principles, not by antitrust principles. And why do I say that? Because I think that eBay answered the question of which principles to apply with the exquisite care. And specifically, what it held was that what the Supreme Court held in eBay was that you could not seek any kind of injunction at all under any circumstances where you could recover legitimate damages under common law for the infringement. So, to my way of thinking, that resolves the issues with respect to standard essential patents. Now, with respect to trolls, I don't think it resolves the issues at all. And frankly, I think that that's fair game for the antitrust laws. Because at the end of the day, there are no contractual principles that apply in that respect. And as I say, my own view is that since there has been no successful legal action brought since Rank Xerox, you need a product in the market in the first instance in order to challenge a troll. Now, that's just my view.
I guess I'll just, in the spirit of keeping things lively and in the hopes of helping the law students in the room who are worried that gosh, everything has been resolved and there are no controversies in which they can make their careers, I'll just mention that Tom's remarks a moment ago about standard essential patents and eBay are interesting, and they're one view, and that's great. It's worth noticing that others have different views, and you know, he may in fact be right and they may in fact be wrong, but we should notice that it's kind of an interesting group of people who have differing views. So that fellow on the Supreme Court who's just oh so associated with left-leaning principles, John Roberts, and that lady who's so famously conservative, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, happened to, in eBay, have joined with each other to say something quite different than what Tom said. So it's possible that he's got a lock on
truth with a capital T, and they are misguided from two very different sides of the political spectrum, but it's possible that all three of them have totally reasonable views, and his are no more reasonable than theirs. And if we don't like academics and justices and commissioners, we might look at presidents and trade representatives, because President Obama's trade representative wrote very clearly recently in the context of standard essential patents that those worried about them should be vigilant about both hold up and reverse hold up. It's possible that it's all as clear as Tom says, but maybe there are a lot of different concerns on the table. And then just to add two more, Henry Smith at Harvard Law School, John Golden at Texas Law School have, as academics are wont to do, engaged in the bookish activity. You think EO 12866 is bookish. The law of remedies is bookish. But they've written a whole set of articles about the law of remedies pre and post eBay. And I think their take collectively in their set of articles is that it's just not clear that it was so clear pre-eBay, and it's even more unclear post-eBay what even eBay says. But I'll just leave it at that. I think for the law students in the room, you've got rich careers to look forward to. There's plenty out there.
Go to the mic, please.
Yeah, hi. If I could just ask a question, two questions to Commissioner Olhausen.
Do you want to identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Jeff Bliss from MLEX. Okay. I just wanted to find out, this talk about a Section 5 guidelines would be academic unless you have your Democratic counterparts are willing to go along. Do you see in the next 12 months some consensus forming? Do you see any movement now?
So Chairwoman Ramirez at the ABA Antitrust Spring Meeting expressed her view that she thought a case-by-case approach was appropriate. Right. So I'm not sure we're all going to join hands anytime soon. But that doesn't mean it's not worth talking about. So.
Right. All right. And there's some debate over about the use of a 6B in terms of the patent and assertion entities. There has been some suggestion of putting out an interim report. Have you heard this? Do you think it's something that the commission would ever consider doing on that particular study?
I actually haven't heard speculation about an interim report. We haven't even gotten our comments back yet on the design of the study. Those are due in December, so.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Everyone comfortable with the exact scope of Section 5? Yeah. Or at least what is to be said about it today.
I'll just, as maybe a final comment, reiterate a point that I think is sometimes lost. I said it in the opening remarks, but it's worth underscoring. You hear people like me or Maureen or Scott or Commissioner Wright say, we want a discipline, we want a structure, we want principles, and that has a restraining effect on enforcement. And that can be characterized as you don't want enforcement, you're just trying to rein it in. I actually think that there's a very important point that says if you can identify a principle that provides guidance, that provides a reason why this particular kind of activity should be unlawful, you will be better able to enforce it. And so there actually is a pro-enforcement element to what Maureen and Commissioner Wright and some others are doing. And I just thought that was a point underscoring to make sure it wasn't lost on folks.
I think unless there are questions, and I don't see anyone coming to the microphone, I'd like you to join me in